I tell you what, you stop paying attention for just a little while. I have a folder on the desktop of my one of my computers at home titled ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I keep a pretty close eye on what's going on in the largest Lutheran church body in the United States. I'm curious. It's also just a matter of wondering, kind of watching the canary in the coal mine. And I thought I was keeping up on things, but as it turns out, this new report on sexuality from the Sexuality Task Force has been released in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. This is the kind of thing you probably will be reading about in the newspapers. Pastor Mark Chavez joins us here in for the first few minutes of this hour to talk about this new report on human sexuality. He is director of a reform movement in the ELCA called Word Alone. Now, a little bit later in the program, we are going to be talking with Dr. M. Scott Peck. He's got a new book out called Glimpses of the Devil, A True Story of Evil Possession, Exorcism, and Redemption. And after that conversation, I'm going to open up the phone lines for your questions and your comments, because there's some things that Dr. M. Scott Peck has to say in the course of that conversation that I think you might find interesting on the nature of evil. How do we measure what is evil? Some very peculiar ideas there, and I'd like your reaction to it, especially given the fact that M. Scott Peck is a best-selling author, The Road Less Traveled, People of the Lie, all of that. Your calls in the last hour of Issues, Etc. Pastor Mark Chavez, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, give us a brief history, if you will, of what it took to get this report on human sexuality actually issued in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
Oh, gosh. Do you want me to back up to the 2001 assembly?
Well, what were the issues that gave rise, or one might say, the need for this report?
Well, from day one, on January 1st, 1988, there's been a hard effort by the pro-homosex groups within the ELCA to convince the ELCA that we ought to give formal approval to homosexual relationships and ordain non-celibate homosexuals and bless same-sex unions. And those leaders on that side were convinced that the ELCA was ready to do that in the early 90s, and as I'm sure you talked about at the time, obviously we weren't ready to do that. And it kind of simmered on the back burner until the 2001 Churchwide Assembly, when again Lutherans Concerned North America, Reconciling in Christ, and Soul Force, which is a larger, you know, ecumenical group, came to the Indianapolis 2001 Churchwide Assembly and argued once again that we ought to ordain non-celibate homosexuals and bless same-sex unions. And that Churchwide Assembly agreed, under a lot of pressure, to engage in a study process. And that assembly voted to have a group look at those two questions and come back with recommendations in the 2005 Churchwide Assembly, and then also to have a new social statement on sexuality be presented to the 2007 Churchwide Assembly. So since Indianapolis in 2001, a task force was appointed, 14 people. They have been at work now for over 3 years, and did two studies. The first one was a brief study, but a longer study that they sent out asked for responses. And then today, their recommendations on those two questions were announced in Chicago.
And what were those recommendations?
They actually came in with three recommendations. Their first recommendation is appeal to find a way that we can live together. They acknowledge that we are deeply divided on this issue. My interpretation of the recommendation is it's an appeal to hold the institution together at the sacrifice of truth and faithfulness to the witness of the Scriptures. The second recommendation has to do with the blessing of same-sex unions. The ELCA does not have a formal policy on that, but in 1993, the Conference of Bishops of the ELCA did issue a pastoral statement in which they said that there is basis, I'm quoting now, there is basis neither in scripture nor tradition for the establishment of an official ceremony by this church for the blessing of a homosexual relationship. We therefore do not approve such a ceremony as an official action of this church's ministry. End of quote. And the second recommendation says that we ought to continue to respect that statement from the bishops, but all of the surrounding language in their report today says, in effect, but it's okay if people decide they want to bless these same-sex unions. The third recommendation is about the question of ordaining non-celibate homosexuals. And I'm reading now from their third recommendation. The Task Force for ELCA Studies on Sexuality recommends that the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America continue under the standards regarding sexual conduct for rostered leaders as set forth in vision and expectations and definition and guidelines for discipline, but that as a pastoral response to the deep divisions among us, this church may choose to refrain from disciplining those who in good conscience and for the sake of outreach ministry and the commitment to the continuing dialogue call or approve partnered gay or lesbian candidates whom they believe to be otherwise in compliance with vision and expectations, and to refrain from disciplining those rostered people so approved and called.
Okay.
Vision and expectations is the policy that only non-celibate homosexuals should be ordained in our church.
Now, the picture is emerging here for me, and tell me if this is an accurate picture. First of all, this is a very bureaucratic response that basically it's an institutional response. Let's stay together in spite of our divisions.
Mm-hmm.
They seem a little more concerned about keeping same-sex ceremonies under control than same-sex unions. You can do the unions. We're just not going to sanction any official ceremonies to do them. And while we acknowledge that we should not be ordaining gays, we may not decide to discipline for other mitigating circumstances if someone does do this. It sounds as though they're giving a green light to both the blessing of same-sex unions and the ordination of homosexual pastors.
Yes, they are definitely giving a green light to it. And the other problem with the way they presented their report is that it's written to lead you to think that they're recommending the ELCA not make any changes in our policies. They even have a sentence in there where they say just that. It's not in the actual recommendation, but it's in the attached rationale, and it reads, quote, therefore, our recommendations do not involve new policy or changes to existing policy, end of quote. But in fact, they are. I mean, they're putting into writing, if this recommendation were adopted by a churchwide assembly in August this year, it would be a fundamental change in the existing policy of the ELCA.
Well, I'm wondering how they're going about that, because I look at the picture that emerges from this report, and I think to myself, there have been instances in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America in the last 2 years where there have been openly lesbian pastors. The congregations in some cases have been sanctioned or disciplined, and then later kind of quietly the sanctions are lifted. And it seems as though in a de facto sense, they can at least say, well, we haven't changed anything. We're not going to change any practices or policies. Because the practices and the policies permitted these things, or at least on the ground they were being permitted anyway.
Right. De facto, we already have a number of synodical bishops and a number of congregations that are disregarding the existing policies of the ELCA, and they're not enforced. The difference, if this recommendation were adopted at our churchwide assembly, is that it would actually put it into writing that it's okay to do that. Whereas now, at least as the policy is written, it's not okay.
What do you find most disturbing about this new report on human sexuality from the Sexuality Task Force in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America?
Well, initially, what I find most disturbing is that they're not being completely above board and being completely transparent. They use language that leads people, and it's already led some of the secular media to use headlines that says the ELCA is recommending no big changes. But in fact, they are. So I wish they were just a little more straightforward and honest about what it is that they've recommended to our church. But it's that first recommendation over the long run that I think I find most disturbing, and I think others as well. It's an appeal to preserve the institution at the expense of the truth, and especially the truth as revealed in the Holy Scriptures, the Old and the New Testaments.
Does a lot of the confusion around this report, around the issues and that have led to this report in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Mark, do they stem from, and this is common to many denominations, including my own, how change occurs, that is, first, we have a policy, we violate it, we ignore it, we act as though it doesn't exist, and we permit in practice things that we don't on paper. And then, 3 years later, 5 years later, a decade later, we say, well, look, this is what we're doing, we might as well make it our policy.
Mm-hmm.
Everything gets put in, everything gets introduced through the back door.
Yes, I think that's a very accurate description, Todd, of what often happens in terms of how we end up in very different situations. I mean, let's use divorce as an example. I don't know that our predecessor church bodies that formed the ELCA ever had in writing that our pastors could not be divorced, but it was certainly an unwritten rule, and usually what happened was that pastors resigned their call at the very least. And little by little, we basically started ignoring pastors who were divorcing. And I know of a candidate recently admitted to one of our seminaries who's been divorced twice. And I think it was a very gradual, incremental change, often not even talked about or written about in a public way, but little by little, you find yourself in a very different position where now you hear ELCA members routinely say, well, the church changed its mind about divorce. Divorce is okay. And we've ended up in a position where we have ELCA members saying exactly the opposite of what our Lord himself says, especially in the Gospels of Matthew and Mark about that matter.
Perusing through, I think it was the ELCA's website some months back, and I came across an audio speech. It was actually a little video from the presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Mm-hmm. And he was giving his State of the Church address. And I listened to it carefully for what he might have to say about same-sex unions and gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very end of the message, his whole speech was about what will a State of the Church address sound like 10 years from now? He was kind of forward-looking. This is what the future of our church is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he said, when the future presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America gets around to talking about human sexuality 10 years from now, he will say, why were we so worried about that? Why were we so divided about it? Why did we think that those questions were such a big deal? And we've learned to live together in spite of our differences. Is that the kind of future you're hoping for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America?
No, not at all. And I think that Bishop Hansen and many of the people in the churchwide offices are completely out of touch with most of our churches and members. There are planning documents posting on the ELCA website where our churchwide organization has been going through this long-range planning and restructuring and so forth. And those planning documents in a couple of places indicate quite clearly that the staff in our churchwide offices in Chicago expect within the next few years that the ELCA will have, in fact, given formal approval to homosexual relationships. And I mean, even the report that came out today is hard evidence that Bishop Hansen and the churchwide leaders are in a very different place than most of our members. Over 57% of the people who responded to the Sexuality Task Force study stated very clearly that they're not in favor of these changes, of ordaining non-celibate homosexuals and blessing same-sex unions. And I have to think that if the membership of the church were surveyed, that the percentage would be even higher.
Is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America perhaps only a step behind other mainline Protestant denominations such as the United Methodist Church, maybe even the Episcopal Church USA, the UCC, the Presbyterian Church USA, that all seem to be taking this same approach, permitting in practice what they ostensibly forbid on paper when it comes to practicing homosexuals?
I wouldn't say that the ELCA is a step behind. I think the ELCA from day one has been marching right alongside those other mainline denominations in terms of disregarding the stated teachings and doctrines and policies of the church. If our churchwide assembly were to approve the task force's recommendation, and again, the recommendation could be modified between now and then, especially by our church council at their meeting in April. But if our churchwide assembly were to approve the recommendations as they were presented today in Chicago, we would be one step right behind the Episcopal Church USA in light of what they did here in Minneapolis in 2003 at their general convention.
Should that really come as a surprise, given the fact that there is a fellowship agreement that one might argue already makes Gene Robinson at least to have the force, the authority of a bishop, mm-hmm, across denominational lines in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America?
Sure, I think that's our agreement with the Episcopal Church was sold as a way to move the two denominations closer together in terms of our mission and ministry and practice. And if our churchwide assembly were to approve this recommendation today, then yes, we'd be right along beside them, and would experience the same disruption, complete disruption, that they already are, both within the Episcopal Church USA, but also there's a potential rupture and schism within the Anglican communion worldwide. And the ELCA, if it approves, even in limited form, of homosexual relationships and behavior, would find itself its relationships with other Lutheran churches worldwide in trouble.
We're talking about this new report issued today in Chicago by the Sexuality Task Force of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America regarding particularly the issues of the blessing of same-sex unions and the issue of whether or not to ordain gay clergy to the pastoral ministry. Pastor Mark Chavez is our guest director of reform movement in the ELCA, Cold Word Alone. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In about 10 minutes, we'll be talking with Dr. Thomas Madden of St. Louis University about the Crusades. So let's walk through the process. You've mentioned several times that there is a churchwide assembly coming up, that this will it be on the docket? Because this has been put off enough times to wonder whether or not this report will actually be up for approval or not when the church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, next meets.
Mm-hmm. No, I think there something will be presented to the churchwide assembly, because there was an attempt in 2003 to delay the vote on these two questions, and that assembly voted very substantially not to delay. So I think that something will be presented, but it could be modified along the way. The procedure is that now it goes to the two divisions that have overseen the study and the task force, the Division for Ministry, the Division for Church and Society, both of which are, at least the staff in the Chicago offices, are very much in favor of change. So they get their chance to do what they want with what the task force has recommended. It will also go to our Conference of Bishops, who meet again in March. They're purely an advisory body, so they won't have the same authority in the process as the divisions for ministry and church and society, but they can certainly weigh in and say what they think about the recommendations. But the key group is our church council, 37 people that will meet in April. And it's up to them to finally vote and decide what they want to recommend to the churchwide assembly. And it's their job to take these recommendations and actually put them in the form of a formal motion or resolution to present to the assembly. But I think at this point, it's unlikely that the churchwide assembly is going to completely dodge the issue.
Finally, my church body, the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, the smaller of the two large Lutheran church bodies in the United States, has been attempting at the kind of the official level some rapprochement with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America of late. What should members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and those involved in interchurch talks know about the future of these issues, gay marriage and gay ordination, the likely future in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America?
Well, I think, first of all, that people in your church should know that these proposed changes and the shift in this direction is coming from a top-down hierarchy in our denomination that's out of touch with most of us in the ELCA, and that they shouldn't project those other views on most of us in the ELCA. And hopefully the members of the ELCA will take responsibility for what gets decided next August. Most of us have no vote whatsoever in the process, but this is an issue that can't be hidden like past issues, for example, called the Common Mission, our agreement with the Episcopal Church. It was hard to get people to even begin to understand what was involved in that, and not easy to understand. But homosexuality is something that most people can immediately understand, and the secular media is giving this a lot of attention. So hopefully the membership in our denomination will be well informed and will weigh in on this, especially at the Synod Assemblies this spring.
With only 10 seconds, when people see the headlines, ELCA proposes no major changes in policy on gays, should they believe it?
No. No. It would be a fundamental change to say it's okay to disregard the scriptures and to disregard the policy of the church.
To stay informed about what's going on in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, you can go to the website for Word Alone. It's wordalone.org. It's a reform group within the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Wordalone.org. Or you can call them toll-free, 1-888-551-7254. 1-888-551-7254. Pastor Mark Chavez, director of this reform movement called Word Alone, thank you for being our guest.
You're welcome, Todd. It's good to be with you.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Dr. Thomas Madden about the Crusades. This is a period in Christian history that is probably most often referenced, but probably least understood. We hope to help in the next hour when we talk about the Crusades.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Today, everyone hails Jesus as a great teacher. But what did Jesus really teach? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for January is Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. David Scare. Discourses in Matthew is $29.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go online to our website, issuesetc.org, and look under the What's New section for more information and a way to order the Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church, by Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. David Scare.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Your inbox may now be slightly less likely to contain pornographic spam. A U.S. district court granted a preliminary injunction telling several companies to stop sending out illegal emails. Could severe penalties be next? Stuart Shepard has more.
The Federal Trade Commission took action under the Canned Spam Act against several companies that advertise pornographic websites through email.
That email has to bear a warning label that says sexually explicit, so that people can tell from looking at the subject line that this email is about sexually explicit imagery and can just delete it.
Eileen Harrington is the FTC's Director of Marketing Practices. She says getting the attention of industry will take successful prosecutions and
sending powerful messages to them through these prosecutions. That is, you better obey this law.
The preliminary injunction will last while the civil suit is underway this year. Penny Nance with the Kids First Coalition calls it an important first step, but she wants to see offenders get jail time.
Recent studies have shown that 3 out of 5 children accidentally are exposed to pornography. That doesn't even count the ones that go looking for it out of curiosity. These are kids who stumble on pornography. It is a huge problem.
Daniel Weiss with Focus on the Family says the successful prosecution of even a few spammers would bring significant change.
Because the best estimates say as few as 100 or 200 people worldwide are responsible for the preponderance of pornographic spam.
Meantime, he says families need to protect themselves while the government moves to put teeth behind the laws. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
This is the first case to be prosecuted under the federal law that requires pornographic spam to carry a warning label. It also requires a valid return email and physical address and prohibits deceptive subject lines. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Alcoholism at home or in the parish, respectful intervention in conflict resolution, the presence of technology and how to control what seems to overwhelm our families. You can get good information and advice about these important subjects at the Family Shield Communications Seminar on Wednesday, February 2nd on Concordia Seminary's campus. It's hope for families just like yours. Registration begins at 8:45 a.m. The cost is $10. Visit FamilyShieldMinistries.com for more information.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January will help you better understand Jesus' parables. It's titled Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. The number at Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours is 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. Discourses in Matthew by Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. David Scare.
Our Issues Etc. book of the month for January is called Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. It's by Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. David Scare. Some of the things that he examines in this book, and I found this of particular interest, he talks about Matthew as a catechist, that is a teacher, a biographer. Most people think of him as at least one of Jesus' biographers, really an evangelist and an apologist. Now, this is something I have not found in other literature written about the Gospel of Matthew. It's something unique to someone like Dr. David Scare and unique to our Issues Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew. The book is $29.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. 25 minutes to do so today. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the book, Discourses in Matthew. 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Right there on the front page, you will find an image of and information on our Issues Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. We will be discussing the Gospel of Matthew tomorrow in a 2-hour conversation with Dr. John Seleska of the Concordia Bible Institute. That's Friday on Issues Etc. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. The Crusades are that period in Christian history that probably are mentioned more than any other period in Christianity's long history. Mentioned by everybody, Christians, non-Christians, skeptics, atheists, they all know at least the phrase, the Crusades. Well, what was this long period of history in the Christian church? What was it all about? And were the Crusades, as they are often as we are often told that they are, a time of kind of bloodthirsty Christians trying to take over the world. Dr. Thomas Madden is our guest. He's chairman of the Department of History at St. Louis University and author of a book, A Concise History of the Crusades. Dr. Madden, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks very much, Tom. Happy to be here.
How do you respond to the popular notion nowadays that the Crusades were a time of really just imperialistic expansion of Christendom by the sword?
Well, that's my first response is to say that that's kind of the imposition of a modern perspective on the Crusades. Imperialism is actually a modern construct, and it's not something that they really understood in the Middle Ages. But beyond that, the fact is that that was not the purpose of the Crusades. The original purpose of the Crusades, the original thing that got them started, was Muslim attacks in the East on Christian territories. And so the purpose of both the First Crusade and, in fact, all of the Crusades was to restore lands that had been conquered by Muslims back to Christian rule. The whole history, in fact, of the Crusades is one of response to Muslim attacks and is, in that respect, could be seen as a defensive action. Now, there are characteristics of it which, to the modern mind, may seem imperialistic. For example, the creation of the Kingdom of Jerusalem in the Near East. But even there, this was viewed at the time. First of all, it's not imperialism since there was no mother country and there was no relationship between the Kingdom of Jerusalem and Europe. But aside from that, the purpose of this was as an outpost. It was not meant to be a colony in the way that we think of it. It was meant to be a way of protecting the holy sites and providing access to them for pilgrims from Europe. So in those ways, it does not meet the standard of what we would consider today to be imperialism.
So why is it that virtually everyone, when you say the words Crusades, at least gets some image in their mind, maybe of a Christian knight marching off and then coming back with, you know, the plunder of war or something like that? They get an image, largely negative. But if you ask someone, tell us about what were the dates, what happened, who were the principal actors, what were the events that brought this about, everyone kind of just shrugs. Why is it that we know the phrase, but we know so little about this period in history?
Well, I don't think it's just the Crusades. I don't think most people know very much about the Middle Ages in general. The difference is that with the Crusades, most people think they know something about it. And that's because the Crusades in the modern world have been recast as something that they weren't. And partially this is a result of, in fact, in totality, it's the result of modern agendas being put back on what the medieval Crusades were. This goes back to really, you can see it in the 18th century with the Enlightenment, but really where Crusades really start being used for modern agendas is in the 19th century. That's when you have nationalists, particularly French nationalists, who will use the history of the Crusades as a kind of an example of their greatness. And then imperialists, both French imperialists and then also imperialists in England and Belgium, will also look to their own past and say, see, this was when we were great. And as we expand around the world, particularly as we expand into the Middle East, we are reliving our glory days of the Crusades. And so what they did was they recast the Crusades as a kind of proto-imperialism, as the first attempt of enlightened Europeans to bring civilization to the backwards Muslim world. Of course, that's the exact opposite of what the Crusades were and what the situation was in the Middle Ages, because in the Middle Ages, Europe was the backwards world and was extremely internally fractious and poor compared to the Muslim world, which was quite large, quite powerful, quite wealthy. But it fit the purposes in the 19th century. And then, of course, in the 20th century, now that the Crusades had been adopted by imperialist rhetoric, in the 20th century, you reached circumstances where imperialism became discredited, where imperialism was no longer a good thing. And when that happened, the Crusades were essentially thrown out, or they were cast in the same way. So they were viewed still, and I think it's still widely viewed, that the Crusades were this first attempt at European imperialism, and as such were bad.
One more thing before we get into the particulars and try to set the record straight on the history of the Crusades, and that is nowadays the Crusades are probably most on people's minds in terms of, well, there's that period in Christian history that has given birth to a modern age of terrorism. What really has the terrorists all worked up is something that actually happened hundreds of years ago, and their view of the Christian West is largely shaped by that those events, the Crusades.
Yeah, the truth in that is that it is true that modern terrorists and sympathizers of terrorists, and also many people just in the Arab street today, their view of the Crusades is one that's just as you said. However, that view doesn't come from an actual memory of the Crusades at all. Where it comes from is the European construction of the Crusades that I just mentioned in the 19th century, which the Europeans themselves, both the English and the French, brought with them to the Middle East when they colonized it. This was the view of the Crusades that was taught in all the colonial schools. The truth is that the memory in the Muslim world, the memory of the Crusades, is actually an artificial memory. It's not as old as the event itself. If you had asked even a very learned Muslim in the Middle East about the Crusades, say, of the 18th century, they would have not known what you were talking about. Because they were just, one is they were not that well understood even at the time they were going on by Muslims. But even beyond that, they were just not important to them. In the great scope of Muslim history, the Crusades just didn't matter. They were important to Europeans, but for Muslims, they didn't matter. They didn't work anyways. They were eminently unsuccessful. So there was no the Crusades didn't have that kind of place in Muslim thought. In fact, they had no place in Muslim thought until Europeans came and gave it to them. And so today, modern Muslims in the Middle East look at the Crusades in much the same way that many of people do in the Western world, because they're getting it from the same source.
So, ironically, the Christian, I've heard Christian commentators say, when the Crusades are mentioned, say, well, okay, but those people weren't Christians, they weren't acting from any Christian motives, there was nothing good, they were just all being motivated by selfish ambition and imperialism, and they simply take the Crusades and try to excise them from real Christian history via do that that way. That Christian who has that judgment of the Crusades actually agrees with the Muslim on the Arab street about the Crusades.
Yeah, to a certain extent. Also, that's just completely wrong. There was a time when historians thought that that might be the case, but in the last 50 or 60 years, there's been an enormous amount of scholarship, very meticulous scholarship that's been done on who the Crusaders were, why they took the cross, what they did when they went on crusades, and what they did afterwards. And we now know from just thousands of crusade charters that have been put into computer databases and examined, we now know that that's not true at all. The Crusaders were people, they were not like someone that you might have found in the 19th century who went off to the colonies to make good. The men who went on the Crusades were men who already had great fiefs. They had great holdings and land. They didn't need to go to the Middle East to take something. They already had a lot at home. In fact, crusading was enormously expensive and extremely dangerous. The reason that they went was because they believed that it was an act of charity and an act of love. In fact, it was viewed in at the time as an act of love for the Christian brothers in the East, those who had been attacked by Muslims and those who had had their lands taken from them. And so they were like the Good Samaritan. They were giving of themselves. They weren't ignoring their brother. They were giving of themselves to go there and help them get back on their feet and to restore those lands that had been taken from them unjustly. And for this, they believe that God would reward them, both, if not here on earth, then he, what they were most worried about was being rewarded in heaven, that they would win heaven by doing these acts of righteousness.
Okay, let's get into the history itself then. What kind of a world do we find where the Muslim world and the Christian world are cheek to jowl here prior to the First Crusades?
Well, the Mediterranean is really the focus of all of this. Christianity had spread across the Mediterranean during the ancient Roman Empire, of course, and then after the fall of the empire, it remained by far the dominant religion throughout the Mediterranean. That means that also includes, and it includes especially, the areas that are today Muslim areas. Egypt, in fact, was the most Christian area in the world back up until as late as the 5th century. The Christian world, therefore, encompassed all of what we think of today in the Middle East, with the exception of Arabia or Persia or something like that. It didn't include that. When the Muslims came out of Arabia and began conquering the Roman world, they then, over time, displaced Christianity, and they conquered Christian lands in Palestine, Syria, and then all across North Africa, Egypt and all of North Africa, which had previously been Christian. And then they also then went across the Straits of Gibraltar and conquered all of Spain, what's today in Spain and Portugal. So, and then subsequent to that, there continued to be additional jihads called or waged against Christians in various areas, in particular Asia Minor, which was the lands that had been, you know, evangelized by St. Paul. These lands have been Christian for many, many centuries. This is the area that's today modern Turkey. And when that was conquered in the 11th century, by that point, you had a situation in which the old Christian world was about almost three-quarters of the old Christian world had been conquered by Muslim armies.
So for just a moment, to put it in kind of a modern context, if we thought about it just, say, in terms of America, not that America is a Christian nation in that sense, but had if all the churches west of the Mississippi were now mosques and we're now having a call to prayer rather than bells ringing on a Sunday morning, call to prayer five times a day, that's what European Christians were looking at in formerly Christian lands.
Yeah, I mean, there were still churches in the areas that Muslims conquered, but of course there weren't nearly as many as there were and as there had been before, and they were at a disadvantage to the Muslim rulers. But yes, it's definitely true. In the medieval world, religion and the state were seen as very much the same type of thing, and in the Western medieval world, religion formed the identity of who you were and of your world. So you could make an analogy of a situation in which there had been, say, large-scale conquest of the United States, but it would be more than just west of the Mississippi. As I said, by the 11th century, a good two-thirds to three-quarters of the old Christian world was gone, including the great patriarchates of Antioch and Alexandria and really major cities like Ephesus were all now controlled by the Muslims. And that's what really led to the Crusades. It was the Byzantine emperor, the Roman emperor in Constantinople, who sent a call to what was really the last remnant of Christendom in the world, in Europe, and asked for help to try to take back Asia Minor, and if possible, to take back more than that. And it was that plea for help that was picked up by the Pope in Europe, Pope Urban II, and then delivered at the Council of Clermont in 1095, and that's what actually began the First Crusade.
Dr. Thomas Madden is our guest. We're talking about the Crusades. He's chairman of the Department of History at St. Louis University. This is Issues, Etc. Okay, tell us about the Council of Clermont in 1095 and the first edict calling for the Crusade, the First Crusade, from Pope Urban II.
Well, Urban this was a regular church council, so they had a lot of reform business to do at the time. But he also delivered a speech, a sermon, to a number of the assembled French nobles who were attending. And it was there that he related this call or this request for aid. And he painted a very vivid picture of some of the things that had been going on in the East. But he understood that most of these French nobles would not have been maybe stirred to give up an enormous amount, including possibly their lives, just to go win back territories for the Greeks, the Byzantine Emperor, because there was not always the best of relationships between the two. So what he did was he also said, it's not only just restoring their lands, these Christians in the East lands in Anatolia, but also to go further and to restore the Holy Land, which had formerly been Christian, back to Christian rule. And there what he did was he gave very vivid descriptions of what had happened when the Turks had taken over in Jerusalem, descriptions that had come to Europe of clergy being tortured or killed, of various people being killed or forcibly converted, and other things that happened in Jerusalem, the destruction of churches and the like. And so by bringing this to their attention and then calling on them to stop warring amongst themselves and start warring to help both their Christian brethren, but also to help restore order in the Holy Land, he was able to infuse in them this great zeal for this. And it worked very well. The Council of Clermont, he obviously gave sermons much better than I do, but by the end of it, he had them all screaming, God wills it. And this was given to preachers who went out across Europe, and it caused a great deal of support.
So, in other words, Pope Urban II was saying, look, our friend in the Near East is calling for our help to restore what has been taken by Muslim aggressors.
Right.
And more than that, the Holy Land needs to be restored into Christian hands.
Yeah, and he's expanding it also by saying these are the things that the Turks, these Muslims, are doing to pilgrims, just regular pilgrims who are going to the Holy Land. They're being treated in this way, and so that needs to stop too. And so it's all wrapped up in a bundle of all good things that need to be done in the East. And this provided for fighting men. You have to remember, the nobility in Europe at this time were all professional soldiers. That's why they were nobles. And professional soldiers knew very well that they deserved to go to hell for what they did, for killing people, in essence. And so they were, all of them, most of them were pious, but all of them cared deeply about where they were going after they died. And so the crusade, although whether it's clear Urban understood this at the time, but it's definitely true, the crusade became a means for these men to use what they knew how to do well, that is fight, for their own salvation, to find a way to do good through warfare rather than just to cause mayhem at home.
Well, that is one of the common criticisms, kind of the theological criticism put forward most lately by Ergun Kaner and his brother. They wrote a book very recently, and we talked with them, called Christian Jihad. And they're both former Muslims, now Christians. Ergun Kaner teaches at Liberty University, I believe. And in an appendix to his book, Dr. Kaner lays side by side the declaration calling for the First Crusade by Urban II and a call for Osama bin Laden for a jihad against the Western world. And he says, you know, in a theological sense, there are remarkable similarities here, that the Crusaders were implicitly told by Urban II that they could make atonement for sins by helping the brothers in the West, that the intentions were good, but the promises were overreaching in a theological sense. What do you make of it?
Well, a couple. It is certainly true that they were told that there was an indulgence associated with the crusade, and so it was considered to be an act of love and charity for which there it had a salutary spiritual effect. So that's definitely true. Canonically, a crusade was very much akin to a pilgrimage. In fact, it was a pilgrimage. The word crusade is a modern word. Crusaders called themselves pilgrims, and they called what they were doing a pilgrimage. And so it had an indulgence associated with it that any other pilgrim would also have. But I would, on the larger point that you raised, I think there are a lot of differences. Jihad, in the way Osama bin Laden understands it and the way traditional Islam understands it, is a requirement of the faithful. It's not something that if you die in a jihad, then you go straight to heaven. But aside from that, it is what a faithful Muslim does. In this case, in Urban II's case, or really in the whole concept of crusade, a Christian need not go on crusade to achieve salvation. It was not an expectation that a Christian had to go on crusade. It was a good thing. It was it was seen as an act of love and charity. And if you did it, then there were lots of spiritual benefits for it. But it was by no means a requirement. In fact, there were plenty of people who were not allowed to go on crusade, including all monks and women and the elderly and the poor and those type.
We're talking with Dr. Thomas Madden about the Crusades, and if you have a question or a comment on the Crusades, call during this break. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, at 5:30 today, we're going to be talking with Dr. M. Scott Peck. It's about a 15-minute conversation. That's going to leave about another 15 minutes for your response to this conversation we'll have with the author of the book, The Road Less Traveled, People of the Lie, and his latest book, Glimpses of the Devil. We're going to be talking about the nature of evil, possession, and exorcism. That's what his latest book is about, and I'd like your reaction to it after that conversation with Dr. M. Scott Peck at 5:30 here on Issues, Etc. Again, those call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, another 25 minutes with Dr. Thomas Madden, Chairman of the Department of History at St. Louis University and author of the book, A Concise History of the Crusades. We're talking about the Crusades. Feel free to join us with questions or comments. The break is a good time to call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.